Thank you, Arya, for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here in Cambridge. So I'm going to talk about sublinear algorithms for sparse signal representation. And in order to do that, I need to first of all I need to explain what sparse representation is, and then what I mean by sublinear algorithms. And in order to explain what sublinear algorithms means to you, I have to first explain, you know, how we actually compute some of these sparse representations. And so this talk has two themes that are sort of current in, as Arya calls it, CHA, computational harmonic analysis. So there are two themes here. And the first one is just plain old sparse representation, which is essentially boils down to some ideas from mathematical approximation theory, and that is that we have some signal or function, or if you want, just a really, really long vector, and we want to represent it or approximate it or compress it with a linear combination of just a small number of atomic elements, basic building blocks, or if you want, basic functions from, or basic vectors from some dictionary. Okay, so the second theme in this talk, along with sparse representation, is sparse recovery. Okay, and so this is the problem where you've got a sparse signal, so possibly a vector which has a small number of non-zero components, or a vector which can be represented with a short linear combination of basic elements. You can reconstruct this signal, or approximately reconstruct it, by making a small number of linear measurements of this vector. Now, you might ask me, well, what a strange model. Where in the world would this come up? Well, it turns out it came up originally in computer science, when people were looking at extremely large data sets. How do you efficiently represent or compress very, very big data sets? And they're the type of measurements that you can make, are small number of linear measurements. It also comes up in sort of modern imaging devices, where it doesn't cost you much to take a linear measurement of your signal, but the number of measurements you care very much about. Okay, so to describe at a slightly more detailed level, but not that much more detailed yet, the sparse recovery problem is I get to look at my signal in a small number of measurements in some fashion, and I want to recover it, meaning I want to find the significant entries in the vector, or find the significant coefficients in the decomposition of this vector over some basis, say. And then sparse representation is really the same problem as sparse recovery. It's just a matter of how do we get to see our input, and what sort of restrictions do we put on our resources. So underlying all of these questions is sort of one fundamental question I have, which is, okay, how do we compute these things? So we can talk about the error of approximation rate from approximation theory. We can we can talk about physical devices to measure images in small ways, but eventually we want to throw this stuff on a computer. How do we compute any of this stuff? And so there are two key components to this work. One is analysis, using intuition from analysis, and then the other one is algorithms. Okay, so let me be more formal and more precise here. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the sparse representation problem. Let's just call it sparse, like the theoretical computer scientists do. So we have a signal space. Let's let this be a vector space of dimension d, either real valued or complex valued. You should think d here is fairly large. So we're talking about fairly long vectors. Okay, we have a dictionary, which is a finite collection of unit norm atoms, or if you want, vectors. So these are vectors that lie on the unit sphere. And sometimes we have, let's also say they span our signal space, which is of dimension d. So sometimes we have more atoms than necessary. So sometimes the size of the dictionary is larger than the dimension. Sometimes we actually have an orthonormal basis. Okay, I actually left off this option here that n is actually equal to d. So we have a dictionary which is a finite collection of unit norm atoms that span Rd or Cd. And we have an input signal s. We want to, given s, find a small linear combination of atoms from the dictionary that add up to s. Now, this is not unique, so we actually want to find the best m term. Let's say m is really, really small. Okay, so we want to find the smallest representation for s. Sometimes m is so small that you can't actually get this to be equal. So you might say, give me the best in L2 error representation here that only uses m terms. Okay, this is a way of talking about the formal mathematical problem of compression or approximation. So where does this arise, and what sort of applications would you find this, or might you be able to extract this sort of mathematical problem? Well, it certainly comes from, it has its mathematical roots in approximation theory. These are certainly all over the place. Certainly the idea of compressing an image or a signal arises in electrical engineering. And to say that you want to find the best M-term approximation over an orthonormal basis is like saying, well, I want to find the minimal distortion code for this, for the certain transform coding. Certainly arises from approximation theory in scientific computing, numerics, in computer science, in data mining, or trying to summarize or approximate massive data sets. You could also view this problem as a generalized decoding problem. I have a collection of vectors on the unit sphere. That's a spherical code. To find the best M-term representation is like saying I want to find the closest linear combination to my received vector point. Okay, on the sphere. The sparse recovery problem arises in modern hyperspectral imaging systems and in medical imaging. So as soon as we're talking about a formal geometric problem or a formal mathematical algorithmic problem, it's worthwhile. And yeah?
This is a very basic question. What does hyperspectral mean?
Oh, it just means that instead of getting information or light in one frequency band, I'll get it in a range of frequency bands. So like I could take a picture in the infrared band and then some other band. Okay. Right. So I have a formal mathematical or algorithmic problem. My find the, given a dictionary, given an input signal of a certain length, I want to find the best in L2 M-term approximation for an arbitrary redundant dictionary, for a dictionary that has more vectors than you actually need to span the space. This problem is NP-hard. It's even NP-complete, which is kind of really, really bad news. If you find a polynomial time algorithm to solve this general problem, let some people know.
For $1 million,
it's even NP hard to approximate to within any factor in polynomial time. So, finding a polynomial time algorithm is kind of a challenge here. This result is a little pessimistic, right? Because you don't find arbitrary redundant dictionaries just on the street. That's not actually what electrical engineers use, and it's not what people in approximation theory use. And you can easily see that if you change this redundancy factor to a single orthonormal basis, then it's really easy to solve this problem in polynomial time. You compute the coefficients of your received vector over this basis. You take their absolute values. You sort them. You take the m biggest. That's the best m term representation for your received signal. And I guarantee you can do that in polynomial time. Okay? So, first of all, for an orthonormal basis, this problem is easy. And second of all, you never stumble across an arbitrary redundant dictionary. People always use specific structured ones. And once you realize that looking at certain structures, if you impose certain structures on these redundant dictionaries, then you can actually get a polynomial time algorithm. So I've tried to put the algorithmic complexity of the general problem and some of its geometrically constrained versions on a chart here, along with some well known algorithms for people who do numerical analysis, so that you can get a flavor of how hard the general problem is, how hard the problem is with some geometric constraints, and then where they lie in relation to the sublinear time algorithms, which I'm going to talk about. At least I'm going to talk about one of them. Okay, so the general problem, well, let's just say we think it's exponential time to solve it, okay? If you impose some geometric constraints on your redundant dictionary, then you can solve this problem in polynomial time. Let's say it's a little bit slower than doing just matrix multiplication. And then here's my favorite, the FFT, which is, you know, somewhere between linear and polynomial time. There is no meaning here to the x-axis. Okay, so I'm going to talk about how to solve some of these problems not in polynomial time, but how to do a randomized approximation algorithm. So how to solve some of these problems in logarithmic time. So not in linear in the length of the signal, but something that will grow logarithmically with the length of the signal. So just for comparison, if you want an exact full computation of the Fourier spectrum of a vector, of the discrete Fourier spectrum of a vector, you can apply the FFT algorithm. Let's say it runs in linear time. But if instead you only want the m most significant entries in the Fourier spectrum, so you're asking for the best m-term Fourier representation of a vector, you could actually get that with high probability and reasonably accurately in, let's say, polynomial in the log of the length of the signal. So you make a small number of samples, and operating in time that's roughly equivalent to these number of samples, you could get pretty close to the right m Fourier coefficients. Okay, so I'm going to talk about how to solve problems like that, not for the Fourier dictionary, but I'll state some results for how to do that for the wavelet orthonormal basis. There are some results sort of hidden in this strange orange box that will also give you sublinear time algorithms for redundant dictionaries which meet these geometric constraints, and also for some which don't meet these geometric constraints. Okay, then I'm going to talk about some recent results where the orthonormal basis that you're trying to do sparse recovery over is the same basis in which you receive or measure the signal in. Okay, so this should sort of set the stage for you for the general problem, and then the types of results I'm going to be talking about down here. Okay, normally when I talk to people who are not who do not do theoretical computer science, but who actually practice computer science, who actually do numerics, I kind of have to translate how the computer scientists refer to and count computational resources. Even though it's something that we understand intuitively, they have a funny language for describing how they count stuff. So the types of resources that we're going to care about and how I'm going to state these results are time. Well, this is sort of an obvious one. We all understand how much time does it take to run my algorithm? How much memory do I need? How much memory do I need to run the algorithm? How much memory, or how much of the signal do I have to observe, or do I get to observe? Is another issue about space. Another issue is randomness. I think this one is perhaps less easy to translate. So it actually costs you something to get true randomness. DRAND 48, for example, is, well, it's only pseudo-randomness. It's really not very good. And you might want to ask, well, so how much randomness am I really getting out of DRAND 48? And if I actually had to go and count how many random bits I'm using, how many am I using? So we're going to count randomness. We're also going to count, or at least think about counting in the back of our minds, communication. So communication is intimately related to space here. A bunch of the sort of data summarization techniques I'm going to talk about, you could imagine deploying on a large number of incredibly resource-constrained devices. So I'm going to talk about algorithms which make very little use of time, space, or randomness, so really cheap devices. We could have really cheap devices summarizing a lot of data and then gathering those summaries in some central location. So in that case, we'd really care about how much communication do those little cheap devices have to make to some central location in order to compute something about the sum, for example, of all the data that they've been collecting. Okay, so this is hopefully an effective translation of how computer scientists count resources. Let's talk about our various models for how we receive our input. Okay, so I'm going to talk about two models. So the first one is sampling. And here I do not mean I'm going to take a regular grid and I'm going to sample a continuous function. Here I've already assumed that I have a discrete vector of length d. And let's assume that it's m sparse in some basis, perhaps in the basis in which we receive it. In other words, it's only got m non-zero entries. Or perhaps it has m non-zero coefficients in some orthonormal basis. Like this might be an m-term trigonometric polynomial. It's not sparse in time, of course, because it oscillates a lot. But it might be sparse in frequency space. Okay, and I'm going to sample this by taking values only in a small number of places. So I've drawn this in a certain way because it will mirror what's going to come next. But I can view this as a binary matrix, a matrix with zeros and ones, and just a small number of ones in the places where I want to actually keep certain entries of this great big long vector. Okay, and this matrix is short and fat, and what I get out is a short vector of measurements. Let's say the number of measurements I get out is m log d. Okay, so I observe my signal here, doot, 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 in m log d places. Okay, and my goal is from this small number of measurements to recover the m non-zero entries in, say, the Fourier basis. So, in other words, to find the m frequencies in here. Okay, I might want to do something more general, or this might model a physical device where it's easy for me to take dot products with my signal, but I really care exactly how many dot products I take. So, for example, I could represent the procedure of taking dot products with my signal just simply here with a matrix. And now, instead of having this might also be a binary matrix, but instead of having a single one and a whole bunch of zeros in each row, I might have, say, random plus minus ones or random zeros and ones. If I don't care that much about computational resources, these might be IID Gaussian entries, etc. But let's just say that this is a sort of input model where I'm charged for the number of dot products I take, not for the amount of resources it takes or the amount of time it takes to compute a single dot product. Okay, so it's easy to do this. Or it's easy to do this computation, and I just care about how many of these things there are. So, for example, you can do this kind of procedure optically, where you're not charged for computing the dot product, just how many dot products you have. Okay, so two models of how we get to observe our data. In both cases, they are linear ways of observing your data. You know, matrix vector product. Okay, so these are linear measurements. All right, now I said that there are two different types of dictionaries, a single straight orthonormal basis or perhaps a redundant orthonormal basis. So the types of orthonormal bases over which we have super duper fast algorithms are the Fourier basis, the wavelets, and spikes. Spikes being just delta functions in time. You certainly could ask for other ones. These are sort of the most natural ones when you're talking about signal or image processing. The types of redundant dictionaries that you could build some of these fast algorithms over are piecewise constants, otherwise known in the data mining community as histograms, wavelet packets. So this is a redundant dictionary based on wavelets. Chirps. So chirps are these are linear time varying chirps, sort of a redundant or generalized version of Fourier. And pardon my singing, but they sound like whoop, whoop. So that's a chirp. Okay, so these are examples of orthonormal bases and redundant dictionaries over which we have sublinear time algorithms for doing signal recovery in either a sampling model or a linear measurement model. Which one you get where depends on the type of dictionary. Okay, so just to give you an example of the flavor of some of these results. So the first one happens to be my favorite because I'm such a fan of the FFT. So for example, the Fourier basis. In this case, the dictionary is simply an orthonormal basis. It's the Fourier basis. And the model in which we observe our signal is simply the sampling model. So we have a signal S, which is of length D. And we have an algorithm which is going to make a very small number of samples, say m times some polynomial in log d over epsilon samples. And this algorithm is going to return an m-term trigonometric polynomial, which is to say it's going to return m frequencies and m coefficients. And the error of that m-term trigonometric polynomial, at least how well it represents or approximates the signal s in L2, error is no more than 1 plus epsilon times the optimal thing that we could do. Now, this is all with high probability. On each signal, we succeed with high probability, and then the running time of this algorithm is m times some polynomial in log d over epsilon. So, you know, we're making that many samples, and we run, you know, roughly in time, essentially linear in the number of samples to return, for the most part, the M most significant features in the spectrum of the signal S. Now, I'm going to be pedantic and point out the quantifiers here. Okay, so on each signal, we succeed with high probability. So theoretically, this means that if you want to observe a number of signals and for each one of them compute, you know, the big terms in the spectrum, in the spectra, you have to flip coins each time and generate a new sample set each time in order to have really good failure guarantees of the algorithm. Okay, so maybe this is a problem, maybe it isn't. It really depends on the setup, but just to be pedantic and point out how these quantifiers go. Okay. For those of you who are maybe not so used to seeing some of these sort of instance optimal type guarantees, notice, and who may be more used to sort of approximation theoretic type guarantees where, damn it, I really want to be within epsilon of my error, not this 1 plus epsilon times, you know, opt. And you're probably thinking, well, I could cook up something that would foil this algorithm. This seems too good to be true. Notice that this is 1 plus epsilon times the optimal error. So you can certainly cook up signals whose best M-term Fourier representation is terrible, whose optimal error is really horrible. Take, for example, a signal which consists of a single spike in time. Its Fourier spectrum is terrible. It's spread out all over the place. There, the optimal error, you know, the optimal M-term error is terrible. And the best thing that this algorithm should do is return zero, nothing. Because then its error is certainly within 1 plus epsilon of junk. Okay, so, okay, good. I have foiled your counterexample. The other thing, cool thing to point out is that if your signal is an exact M-term representation, then the optimal error is zero. And the algorithm finds it exactly. you're within 1 plus epsilon times 0. Okay. Yeah?
What is the with higher probability here? I mean,
So the sample set, I'm going to choose these samples. It's chosen at random. Okay? And so that's the sample space, so to speak, for the probability. So I flip coins.
I understand probability theory. The question is, what is the probability that you'll succeed? Is it 1 minus e to the minus?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I'm suppressing factors of log 1 over delta. So if you want to succeed with probability 1 minus delta, or fail with probability delta, then these things scale with log 1 over delta. So this is a standard result from randomized approximation theory. I mean, it sort of comes out of a...
This is a concentration of measure type.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
It's actually a simple application of Chernoff. Nothing too fancy. I'm going to suppress all of these factors because it's just log 1 over delta to get failure probability delta. Okay, I guess what I really want to be a bit more pedantic about is whether it's on each signal or for all signals. Okay, so you can do, there are similar results for a different orthonormal basis dictionary, the wavelet dictionary, or the wavelet basis. Now, in this case, the way in which you observe the signal has to be different. Okay, in this case, the way that you observe the signal is you're allowed to take dot products with random vectors. Okay, so in this case, your matrix is no longer one of these sampling matrices, it's one of these brightly colored matrices. Okay, and you can either charge yourself for the total number of dot products you take, or you can charge yourself per update. So each time you change an entry in your great big long vector, you come down here, you change one of these things, that just means you have to go to the appropriate column in your brightly colored matrix and figure out what that column is, which is, again, equivalent to saying, you know, how many rows are in that matrix? Okay, so two different ways of charging yourself with the same result. How many rows are in that matrix? And how quickly could I generate an arbitrary column of that matrix? Okay, so here's the model and the dictionary. Here's the result. We again have a signal of length d. You might think of d as absolutely gigantic. And a streaming algorithm is a two-word phrase which is encapsulating our input model. Okay, so either we get to observe random dot products, or we're only charging ourselves for a single update in a certain row of the vector. So we have a streaming algorithm which will return the near best m-term wavelet approximation in time. Now here the time scale is like some polynomial in m times log d over epsilon. And the number of rows in our measurement matrix is, again, some polynomial in m times log d over epsilon. And we get the same kind of goodness guarantees for our output. So the L2 error of our m-term wavelet representation is no more than 1 plus epsilon times the optimal error. And again, here, the order of the quantifiers is that on each signal, we succeed with high probability. And again, with this log 1 over delta failure probability. Delta stuff. Okay, so you might ask, well, we've done the Fourier basis, we've done the wavelet basis. How about spikes? Suppose, I mean, I've received the vector in time, decode in Fourier, so sort of orthogonal, if you will. I've done receive the vector in time and decode in wavelet, which is not quite orthogonal. And, actually, not quite lining up exactly. But how about decoding in exactly the same in exactly the same basis? Now, I want to point out to you that this input model, I get to take linear, or I'm restricted to taking dot products with my signal. Okay, I'm not going to march down my signal one entry at a time to try and find the big guys in that signal. Okay, mainly because the motivation for this type of result comes from actual physical devices where you can't actually walk down your signal one entry at a time. It's too expensive. It's much, much cheaper to be able to take linear measurements, say optically, and then just record the answers that you get along the rows of this short fat matrix. Okay, so our input model is this random dot product model, and the dictionary over which we're decoding or over which we want to find significant entries is the spikes, the same basis in which we observe the signal. Okay, now here the order of the quantifiers gets stronger. So we're gonna say with probability at least 1 minus d to the minus 3. So we're going to fail with probability 1 over d cubed. No, reasonably small failure probability. With reasonably small failure probability, we're going to construct a single measurement matrix phi. It's one of these brightly colored short fat matrices. And we're going to construct this one matrix, but we're going to do it randomly. Okay, and here's the probability failures over that space, over which we generate it randomly. Okay, so this one single vector, this one single matrix is going to have the following property. If we take any d-dimensional signal, which has a best m-term approximation with respect to the L1 norm given by S sub m, then the number of rows in our matrix phi is simply m times log squared d. And we run an algorithm called chaining pursuit, which is going to find roughly O of m non-zero entries in our signal, big guys. And the error that we make in L1 with this algorithm is no more than a constant times log m times the optimal error in L1 norm. And this is a fast algorithm, so it scales like m log squared d, roughly. Okay, so it's a sublinear time algorithm, sublinear in the length of the signal. It's what we call a uniform or a universal algorithm in that we have a single measurement matrix for all signals S, for all d-dimensional signals S. Okay, now, it's a random construction of phi, so there's some probability of producing a bad phi, but all we have to do is produce one. Now, this result is maybe not quite exactly what you'd want in that we've got an L1 norm here and L1 norm here, and we don't have this 1 plus epsilon factor here. We have just some factor that scales like log m. Okay, so you might ask, can you do better? Yeah, you can do better, but with more work. So you can improve this to an L2 type error, but the L2 error is bounded by some funny mixed norm. Okay, I'm going to explain this funny mixed norm in a few more slides. It's actually necessary. So Ron DeVore and Wolfgang Dahmen and Albert Cohen have proven a lower bound, saying that if you want to get an L2 error, so the L2 error of your algorithm bounded by 1 plus epsilon times the optimal L2 error, if you want that plus one of these sort of universal guarantees where you have a single measurement matrix for all signals S, then you need D measurements. In other words, you can't have a very small number of rows in your measurement matrix. And so this is sort of the best that you can do with a very limited number of measurements. This is basically why we have to have this funny mixed norm. Okay, so again, this is a similar type result. We construct a single measurement matrix, albeit randomly. The number of rows in this measurement matrix is m times some polynomial in log d over epsilon squared. We're going to return roughly the m biggest entries, and roughly here is captured by this error estimate. And the time cost of this algorithm is not m times some polynomial in log d, but m squared times some polynomial in log d. So it's slightly it has a slightly better error performance than Spikes 1. It has a slightly slower running time also than Spikes 1. So I called the previous one Spikes 1. Let's call this one Spikes 2. Spikes 2 is kind of a sophisticated algorithm to explain in a short amount of time, so I'm just going to focus on Spikes 1, the first result, which is an L1 result. Okay, so I've mentioned a bunch of the things that we would want out of the performance of such algorithms. Let me enumerate them clearly. So here are our desiderata. So first of all, we want a guarantee that's uniform or universal, if you will. This sketch, this single measurement matrix phi, this brightly colored one, should work for all signals simultaneously. So what kind of practical impact would this have? I mean, it has a mathematical impact. It's got much, much stronger order of quantifiers, but it actually has a practical engineering impact. So I said that the motivation for these types of models came from actual imaging physical devices. So you can, and in fact, people have built spectroscopy systems that will take these measurements optically. And physically, or engineering-wise, what this uniform guarantee means is that they just have to make one coded aperture and slide it into their spectroscopy system and then collect measurements. Now, how they actually generate this single coded aperture is, you know, it's a probabilistic process, and there's some probability that they get a bad one, but they just have to do one to take a whole bunch of measurements of a whole bunch of signals. Now, if they had the weaker type of guarantees, theoretically speaking, the theorems would say each time they want to measure a new signal, they'd have to go to the manufacturer and make a new one of these coded apertures, which engineering-wise is a pain. So not only is there a good mathematical reason for doing this, but there's a good engineering reason for asking for this. Now, optimal size and optimal speed are for, you know, optimal uses of resources where we want to be as efficient as possible. Okay, so a small number of measurements. Remember, we're outputting something that's roughly only of size m, right? So the right way to do this is to use resources which also scale like m. No, okay, so we've got m times some polynomial in log d, and here m times some polynomial in log d. But that's a heck of a lot better than scaling like a polynomial in d, okay, which other algorithms do. Okay, so if you're going to find something, you're going to output something of size m, you should be running in space and in time roughly of size m. That's the right way to do it. Okay, so these are our three desiderata. In order not to have vacuous results, we actually want to have a high-quality answer as well. Okay, so we have two results which meet, you know, for the most part, these three desiderata. Okay, maybe I should say something about the appropriateness of instance optimal results. So most of the time, people who do numerics or who are familiar with approximation theory really want to know, well, what's the approximation rate for this class of functions? You know, things that are so many times differentiable are, you know, can be approximated at such and such a rate using wavelets, for example. Okay, and they really want to know, you know, is my error of my algorithm within epsilon? Okay, and the answer is that for most, well, actually I should say, for compressible signals, these instance optimal results are actually good. I mean, they're what you think of when you think of error rates for various functional classes. So all we're saying here is that a highly compressible signal has an optimal error that decays quickly in M. And so we can guarantee that for compressible signals, our output is good. Then we can tell you, yeah, it's within, you know, not only is it within a certain factor of the optimal, but we know that the optimal goes like m to some power. And so we can tell you exactly a number. Okay, so this slide is a summary of the lower bound and the basically saying that our mixed error guarantee for spikes 2 is a reasonable thing. Okay, so you might ask, well, how do these results compare to, how are these results any better or any different from what people have tried before? And the answer is, roughly speaking, that these three desiderata that people wanted, previous results could get some combination of two of these three desiderata. So, for example, if you want a uniform guarantee, so this is the extremely strong order of quantifiers, then work by Kormode and Muthukrishnan and also Kandas, Romberg, Tao, and Donahoe could get you this sort of uniform guarantee. Now, you might want to ask for optimal use of resources, so both small memory and small answer time. Well, you know, none of these three results could give you all three. And so the two algorithms that I'm going to talk about actually do achieve all three of these things. These are hiding all kinds of gross factors. So they're not strictly comparable, but morally speaking, they are. Okay, so I said I was going to focus on the first spikes algorithm because it's something that you can explain in 15 minutes. So it's got several parts to it. First of all, it's got the sketches. I need to tell you what these measurement matrices look like. If you were building a spectroscopy system, that's the first thing you'd want to know is, well, what should I tell those guys to make for my coded aperture? Okay, then you'd want to know, well, how does the reconstruction algorithm work? Because I'm going to collect my measurements optically, and then I'm going to throw them on a computer. I'm going to actually have to compute things about my signal. So how do I do that? So I'm going to do that in that order. I'm going to do the sketches first, and then at a high level, what the algorithm is. And then as mathematicians, you should ask me later at T, so how do you prove that the algorithm is correct and that it works? Okay. So, at one level, the chaining algorithm, which is spikes 1, the first result, the matrix is really pretty simple, sort of. So it consists of two parts. The first part is really simple. It's simply bit testing, and that I can explain in detail in one slide, actually with a single picture. So it's got bit testing, and then it's got what we call multiple trials of isolation, which is a fancy way of saying we're going to construct this matrix by throwing balls into bins. And then mathematically, we do very careful analysis of a balls into bins procedure of repeated trials. And then computationally speaking, we do a clever way of assigning balls into bins, not with full randomness, but only with pseudo-randomness, and so that we can actually compute columns of this matrix very, very quickly. Okay, so let me explain what the bit testers are, because this is actually something we can do in a single page. Okay, so suppose we have a great big long signal, which is all zeros except for one single spike. Okay, here's our measurement matrix. It has three rows and eight columns. So log base 2 of 8 is 3. We're finding a single spike, so it's got the right number of rows for the number of columns. And the columns of this matrix are simply the numbers 0 through 7, or if you will, 1 through 8, minus 1, in binary. It's certain rows of a Hadamard matrix. It is a very simple binary error-correcting code. Okay, and if you compute these dot products, you will find a vector of length 3, and the decoding algorithm is simply this vector is the address in binary of the position of the spike. That's it. So I just told you what the measurement matrix is. I told you what the decoding algorithm is. I really don't have to show you that it's correct. You can just eyeball it and say, yeah, it's correct. And so that's it. Well, okay. So, here's the picture. If you were a spectroscoper, this is the picture of the coded aperture matrix you would go have somebody manufacture. And in fact, people have made wave meters using exactly this aperture. Okay. Now, this procedure works if you have a single spike. Right? So we want to be able to do not only positive spikes, but negative spikes, and more than just one. So we want to do a signal that has something like this. These bit testers get horribly confused if you have two spikes, and you can screw them up. So you need some way to isolate this guy from this guy. And we're just going to do that with a balls and bins type assignment. Okay, so in order to use these bit tests, we need to isolate these guys. Okay, now to isolate these guys, we're going to assign each of these D signal positions at random to one of, say, M different subsets. Okay, so we get, let's say there are eight positions. No, there are three spikes here. We want to build roughly three different signals here. And hopefully, with reasonable probability, this guy's isolated, this guy's isolated, this guy's isolated, and then we can apply our bit tester to this one, and this one. Okay, so how do we actually do that with our isolation matrix? Well, that's simple, right? You can partition these signal positions into different subsets using a 0-1 matrix. So this first position goes into the second measurement bucket. The second signal position goes into the first measurement bucket, etc. Okay, so this is how you do the assignment of the positions into subsets. And now we actually want to employ some sort of concentration of measure or some large deviation property here. We're going to actually have to partition this signal some number of different times, so some number of t times. So we're going to do repeated independent trials of partitioning like this. So you get sort of a layer cake binary matrix. What that's doing is actually known in the combinatorics literature as combinatorial group testing. So it's we're doing sort of an approximate probabilistic version of group testing, but nonetheless, that's what we're doing. Maybe we'll skip that, and I'll show you a picture. This is an example of what the isolation matrix would look like. Now, you have to follow that isolation procedure with a bit testing matrix. So linear algebraically speaking, you're doing a row tensor product of this matrix with the bit tensor matrix, with the bit testing matrix, and this is the sort of picture that you would get. This has good computational properties and bad optical properties. You can see what the bad optical properties are. It's probably pretty hard to see those dots way in the back, right? So this is the kind of aperture that doesn't let in much light. So it's kind of hard to take measurements, count photons, when you're blocking most of the light. Now, computationally speaking, this is a good thing, because all I need to know is to compute quickly the positions of the ones. And there aren't that many of them. So and the fact that there aren't very many of them means that you can store this efficiently. You can also generate them efficiently. So this sort of design has its good points and its bad points. But that's what it looks like. Okay, so I've told you what these matrices look like. I've shown you pictures of them. You're all set now to implement this. What kind of algorithm would you use? Well, you'd use, roughly speaking, a greedy pursuit type algorithm. Now, to say it's a greedy pursuit algorithm is sort of hiding some of its sophistication. So it's an iterative procedure. And the iteration goes like this. The first thing you want to do is identify candidate heavy hitters. So give me a list of candidate positions where big spikes are, big in magnitude. Not how big they are, but where they are. Okay, then estimate how big they are. You've got a candidate list. You've actually got to prune or cull some of these candidates because they can't all be good. Okay. Then you've got to update your sketch. Okay, so this is hiding a lot of sins. So you're gonna get estimates of spikes, and you're gonna get their positions. You have to subtract them off from the residual signal, or the current signal, and iterate on the residual. Okay, now if you're doing this in a resource clever fashion, remember you haven't kept the original signal. You've just kept a small number of measurements of the original signal. You've thrown the original signal away. It's on the floor somewhere. So you have to remember this is a linear procedure. You have to measure or collect a measurement of your list of spikes where you are now, so you get a short vector. Subtract that from the short vector of the current signal, right? That's a fast procedure. You can do that. Everything's small. And then update on the update your current thing and iterate on the residual. Okay, so you have to be able to remeasure each spike in the iteration procedure quickly. So your computer, your device, your processing device needs to have this measurement matrix stored somehow in it as well. It's not enough just to put it in your optical device. Okay, so that means that you have to design this measurement matrix from an intelligent way, engineering-wise, just physically. What's a good way to take measurements? And you also have to keep in mind that you're going to be computing with it. So what are good ways to store it, to generate it quickly, etc. Okay, once you have a residual, you just iterate on this procedure. Okay, that's actually it for well, at a very high level. For how these algorithms work. Why they work is another matter. When why they're correct is another matter. Okay, so I can go quickly through these, at least for this first algorithm called chaining pursuit. So roughly speaking, the way that you show that this algorithm is correct is you realize that the algorithm is designed to find a constant proportion of the big guys at each iteration. So it's going to try and pull off a constant fraction of whoever is big at each step. And if you're pulling off a constant fraction at each step and not making too many errors, then you can terminate after a small number of steps. Okay? Now, you're going to make errors along the way because you can't estimate things exactly correctly, and maybe you get some false candidate heavy hitters. So you actually have to be careful in analyzing which guys you throw out and which guys you keep. Also, each time you make an estimate, it might be slightly wrong. So you might have some difference in the height of the true spike and the estimated spike. And what that generates for you is what we call internal noise. So there's external noise, it's just noise in the measurements. But then each time through the algorithm, you make noise. And that noise starts to add up after a certain number of rounds of this procedure. So you have to make sure that the noise is reasonably spread out and that it doesn't grow faster than you're sort of eliminating big spikes, and also that you're not doing too many iterations, because each time the noise is going to grow. So you have to do pretty careful analysis of this internal noise. Okay, you also want to guarantee, I hopefully convinced you that the algorithm runs in small space and that it runs in small time. I actually have to show you that it runs in small space and in small time. And hopefully I convinced you that one of the main bottlenecks in the algorithm's running time is in remeasuring, or in measuring the estimates of your spikes that you found at your current iteration. So you've got a list of big guys and how big they are. You need to collect their measurements and subtract them from the current measurements, or the measurements of the current signal. Because you can't subtract them from the original signal. You've thrown that on the floor. So in order to do that, you've got to have your measurement matrix, and then you've got a small number of entries here in your great big long vector, which means that you have to go to the right columns in this measurement matrix and be able to add up the columns quickly. So you need to be able to generate the columns and add them up quickly. So you can do that if you've designed your measurement matrix in a smart way. Okay, so this is basically the statement that you need to multiply your matrix with a constant number of non-zeros per column. And the way that you do that, keeping in mind efficient use of space and efficient use of randomness, is to use a family of random variables that's not fully independent. So I'm not going to place balls into bins with full IID, full IID randomness. I'm going to do this only M-wise independent. So not fully I, identically distributed, but M-wise independence. And the way that you generate families of random variables with limited independence is to uh, such that any m of them can be computed quickly in time linear in m, is to take a random degree m polynomial over some prime which is bigger than the dimension. Okay, and then this procedure boils down to a multipoint polynomial evaluation over a prime field, which you can do efficiently. Okay, so we implemented the first algorithm just to verify for ourselves that it really was a sublinear algorithm, both in terms of time and space. So this is MATLAB, so it's a prototype implementation. It's a little clunky, and perhaps the example is a little bit hokey, but it does at least show you the power of logarithmic growth. So here's the dimension d. We were ramping it up bigger and bigger and bigger, and we kept the number of significant spikes fixed at 16, which is not really big once you get up to dimension 18,000, but it's okay. Now, so this is a running time for finding the 16 spikes. Now, the only other reasonably fast algorithm for which we had theoretical guarantees was an algorithm called orthogonal matching pursuit, which is at least linear in the dimension. Okay, so there we go. That's growing at least linearly in the dimension. Here's logarithmic growth in the dimension. So it's exponentially faster than this thing, which is pretty good even in MATLAB. Okay, so we're talking to some folks. We're talking to some folks at Duke University in the U.S. on some optical imaging and hyperspectral imaging applications of these algorithms. And before they knew what we were doing and before we knew what they were doing, they had built one of these bit testers optically. So they had built a wave meter, which had a tunable laser, and they wanted to figure out which of however many frequency bins the laser was shining at. And they wanted, let's say they had D different frequency bins that the laser, contiguous, that the laser could shine at. They wanted to figure out if they could figure out what wavelength the laser was operating at without using D measurements. And they could actually build one of these wave meters using the bit testing coded aperture and log D photon collectors. And they could actually image the position in binary of the frequency. Just like that little matrix I showed you, they did all of that optically. Long before we ever talked to them and they ever talked to us. So they also built something which could do a superposition of different wavelengths. So an honest-to-God spectrometer. Not just a simple wave meter. Yeah, it was a little hokey, but it sort of worked. Their main problem was their reconstruction algorithm. So they're set up with something like this. They had a laser, you know, hit some source. It went through a lens, a diffraction grating. Here's their coded mask here. That's their matrix. That's the picture of their matrix. Okay, and then they collected the measurements here. What they wanted to do was they wanted to reconstruct the significant wavelet coefficients of the spectra. This isn't the best way to do it, but needless to say, that they could actually build this device to do that. And this is an example spectrum of the you know, they were trying to recover the significant wavelet coefficients that you would use to represent this thing. Okay, so we're working with them on one type of imaging application of a bunch of these algorithms, and if you want to find out more, you can look at my webpage, or send me email. Thanks.